Welcome to the Real Python Podcast. This is episode 300. Do you feel like your Python skills are atrophying after using LLM coding tools? How do you add the right kind of friction into your coding routine to keep your developer instincts sharp? Christopher Trudeau is back on the show this week with another batch of PyCoders Weekly articles and projects. We discuss a recent article by previous guest Bob Belderboss about developers keeping their instincts when AI is writing the code. He stresses the importance of the right kind of friction for maintaining skills and scheduling a deliberate coding practice routine. We also share several other articles and projects from the Python community, including recent releases, a roundup of real Python tutorials and video courses from the top of June, sending emails with Python, libraries to enhance your Python polar's workflows, exploring Django integrity policy, a next-generation HTTP client for Python, and a project to detect lazy imports incompatibilities. This week's episode is brought to you by Ori by Endor Labs. Security teams talk risk. Developers talk function. Ori is the common language between them. Free tools for developers and AI agents to detect vulnerabilities, block malware, and fix security bugs. Try it at endorlabs.com. All right, let's get started. The Real Python Podcast is a weekly conversation about using Python in the real world. My name is Christopher Bailey, your host. Each week, we feature interviews with experts in the community and discussions about the topics, articles, and courses found at realpython.com. After the podcast, join us and learn real-world Python skills with a community of experts at realpython.com. Hey there, Christopher. It's time to celebrate episode 300.
Yes, 300. Congratulations.
Yeah. Just over 6 years of the Real Python Podcast. So thanks everybody for listening. We're trying to grow what we're doing. And so there's a survey, if you go to the show notes for pretty much any episode that might pop up and ask you some questions. We're kind of wondering, like, do you want more detailed show notes? Do you know, what are the things that you want and so forth? If you have a chance, check it out. And, you know, the show notes are always full of good links and other information for you and easy ways to hop around to the different chapters. We have our usual slate of news and items and a couple projects. So you ready to dig in?
Yeah, let's do this.
All right. What do you got for news?
Well, sort of a regular amount of news this week for a change, starting with three Python releases. First off, two bug fixes. That's 3.14.6 and 3.13.14. That 13 one just keeps going. Nothing earth-shaking here. Just the usual squashing and security stuff. To go along with it, beta 2 of Python 3.15 has come out. That's two more to go until the release candidate. Sticking with the theme, Django 6.0.6 and 5.2.15 came out and contain a few security fixes, one of which involves a situation where sending email through TLS doesn't actually use TLS. Oh. So you might want to get on that.
Yeah.
And then finally, PyPy, the alternate Python interpreter, released version 7.3.23. These guys have been busy lately. Yes, this one's just a bug fix, though, so just sort of patching stuff from the last one. And, well, not quite finally, I guess. There was also a Polars release, but seeing as we have a whole segment on that, I'm going to leave that there.
Yeah, I'll be talking about that in a few minutes here. To kind of continue the news, I decided to try out a new segment. I'm calling it the Real Python News, and I feel like a lot of people, this is the Real Python Podcast, and they might wonder, well, what's happening at Real Python? So I thought I'd gather what's been happening, what are the new releases as far as tutorials and video courses, and share them with you in kind of a sped up fashion so you can get an idea what's happening. And of course, links will be in the show notes. So what's happening at realpython.com to start the month of June 2026? Sometimes you need to make your Python sleep, wait, or pause before running the next line of code. We have an updated written tutorial by our friend Leodonis Pozo Ramos titled Python Sleep, How to Add Time Delay to Your Code. Whether you're spacing out API requests or pacing a thread or adding a delay to your terminal output, Python's time.sleep function is the standard tool. There is an associated video course with that and a quiz to test your knowledge. On the video course side, a new video course by a new instructor, David Asboth, titled Structuring Your Python Script. So many new users of Python will find themselves transitioning from like interactive environments. Maybe they're using notebooks or just playing around in the REPL, and they want to move toward actually making scripts, which is a normal progression. Well, what are some good practices to get you started? This video course shows you the foundations of organizing a Python script, where the runnable bits go, how to arrange your imports, and how to refactor with constants and a fixed entry point. We have a new written article from previous guest Bartosz Jaczynski titled, How to Use GitHub Copilot Code Review in Pull Requests. So GitHub offers several AI tools under the Copilot umbrella. That's saying just a little bit there, that cover your entire development workflow. And Copilot can provide an AI-powered code review shortly after you open a pull request on GitHub. So rather than waiting for a teammate, you can add Copilot as a reviewer to receive context-aware feedback. With access to your entire code base, it delivers actionable suggestions that you can apply in just a few clicks. Video instructor Joseph Pert has a new video course up on the site. He is exploring Open Router API. The title is Accessing Multiple AI Models with the Open Router API. It's one of the quickest ways you can call multiple AI models from a single Python script. It acts as a unified routing layer between your code and multiple AI providers. By the end of the course, you'll be able to access models from several providers through one unified API. The AI ecosystem is highly fragmented. Each provider exposes its own API, authentication scheme, rate limits, model lineup. Working with multiple providers often requires additional setup and integration efforts. So especially if you want to experiment with different models or compare outputs or evaluate trade-offs and specific tasks. So this tool, OpenRouter, gives you access to thousands of models. There's no subscription, and you can sort of set time limits. I think of it like buying a prepaid card, whether it's phone calls, boy, I'm old, or maybe you've been to a wine bar or a brew house and they gave you a card with a certain amount of funds on it. You can kind of think of it that way if you want to get drunk on your favorite AI tools. So to wrap things up, RealPython has a new tutorial by another new face. Brian Mutea has a piece titled Cursor versus Windsurf, which AI code editor is best for Python. Instead of having to switch between your code editor and a separate AI chat, you can use tools like Cursor or Windsurf that bring AI directly into your workflow. Both Cursor and Windsurf are VS Code forks that import key bindings, themes, and Python extensions, and both run the same frontier models. They look similar at first, but diverge in how they handle changes you build. A quick note on both. Cursor focuses on control, surfacing AI-generated edits as reviewable diffs and explicit rules to guide agent behavior, whereas Windsurf focuses more on flow, applying edits directly in the editor while using broader workspace context, including terminal output, recent edits, and conversation history to shape its behavior. So that's what's been happening at RealPython for the start of June 2026. All right, you ready to dig into your first topic this week?
Sure, let's do this. My first article is by John Fincher at RealPython, and it's titled Sending Emails with Python. Let's just get this out of the way to begin with. Society's acceptance of the pluralization of email with an S was a sign of the end times. You don't write letters and put them in the mails. What was I saying? Anyways, I was distracted by someone on my lawn. Right, so sending email. As part of its batteries included attitude, Python has modules for sending email. Email's kind of an interesting protocol. It's rather antiquated and is one of the original parts of the internet. It's based on work done on ARPANET, which is what evolved into the internet. Its age means that there are some design decisions that could be considered quaint nowadays. Having just recently hit another birthday, I feel quaint nowadays myself.
Happy birthday.
First off, sending email and fetching your email are different protocols. If you've ever wondered why, it's because fetching email used to be done locally, so you didn't need a protocol. You logged into your own machine and your mail was there available as data. So this article concentrates on the sending side, which is done through the Simple Mail Transfer Protocol, or SMTP, to its friends. Naming it simple was kind of prescient. SMTP is a text-based protocol. So even today, you can remotely connect to a mail server and type in the commands to send an email to that box. The original forum didn't even have logins. Everyone on ARPANET trusted each other, which is kind of funny considering it was a military project. Of course, doing all of this by hand is painful, so Python provides SMTP lib. This module has a couple of classes that you use to establish a connection to a mail server. The first one I'll talk about is named SMTP, logically enough. When you construct the object, you pass it the hostname and port of the mail server that you want to connect to. You can invoke an SMTP object through a context manager, which is handy because then you don't have to remember to close the connection. It'll do it for you. So once you've got your connection, you call a method to send a message. There are a couple of methods that do this. One of them requires a little more work, and one that doesn't, which is where I'm going to focus. The latter is called sendMessage, again with that logic thing, and it takes an emailMessage class. The emailMessage class got added later than smtplib, and it's in its own module. You'll find it in email.message. This class works a lot like a dictionary. You instantiate it, then you use square bracket key style notation to set the various properties of your message. A basic email message needs a to field, a from field, a subject field, and some body content. If you've ever looked at the raw source of an email, you'll see that they have headers in them. The headers specify things like the to, from, and subject, as well as encoding info and other stuff. This is separate from the body. To set the body on an email message object, you call the setContent method and pass in what you want to say. Once you've got your object prepared, you pass it into SMTP's sendMessage method, and you're done. You've sent an email. If you're sticking to just those basic fields, the amount of work to use an email message object and the more primitive stuff that I glossed over is about the same. Where email message shines is it also allows you to set CC, BCC, reply to, lets you specify any of these fields as a string, as an address object, which is how you do display names, or it'll even support lists of those things so that you can have multiple addressees. You're probably used to prettier email rather than plain text. This is accomplished through HTML. Not all mail clients support rendering HTML. And of course, HTML was invented way after SMTP. So email treats HTML as an alternative, and best practice is to include both plain text and HTML in your message bodies. To do this, the email message object has an add alternative method, which allows you to attach HTML to your note. It's a little hard to describe in a podcast, but the article shows you the resulting text and how the message body gets chopped up into sections through a boundary marker. But wait, there's more. Email message also handles attachments. Email is a text-based protocol, so any binary attachment needs to be converted into a text-friendly format. The most common way to do that is to use the Base64 encoding mechanism, which translates a byte into a series of printable ASCII characters that are safe to send in mail. One of the beauties of that email message object is you don't have to think about any of that. You simply call add attachment and then pass in your bytes, and it takes care of the rest for you. Modern mail servers are a little pickier about who can connect to them and send mail. We can't all be as trusting as the United States Department of Defense. This typically means two things. First, you need to use SSL to talk to the server. And second, once you connect, you have to log in, or authenticate, to be more specific. The good news is that's really only a couple of extra lines of code. Instead of using an SMTP object, you can use the SMTP SSL class instead, and you get encryption. The class still takes a host and port, but it also needs an SSL context object, which you can get with a quick call to Python's SSL library. So an extra line of code and swapping your SMTP class for the SMTP SSL class is all you need for encryption. The authentication mechanism might be as simple as one more line, calling the login method on the server object. I say might because modern mail servers don't always allow you to authenticate using a username and password. Sometimes you need OAuth2 and a security key or other mechanisms. To help you get practice sending mail in the modern, more secure world, the article covers how to create a Gmail account, including its app password feature, which is a way of adding a password to your account that isn't your login password, specifically so that you can use the password in scripts. The article also briefly talks about other providers than Google, a couple of specialty third-party libraries for connecting in more complex situations, for example, that OAuth2, and introduces you to transaction email services in case you want to annoy lots of people at the same time with like a newsletter or something like that. Good stuff here from John, very comprehensive with good examples so you can code along. And I'm in the progress of turning this one into a video course, so if you want my snarky voiceover instead of reading, then that option is coming soon as well.
All right, coming attractions. This is one of the first things I did as sort of that transition from beginner to intermediate. That was actually at a job. Again, I was working for a marketing department. And so occasionally we were creating email stuff and email templates. And so I was practicing with it. It was a good thing to learn. I think it's a good library to kind of mess around with if you're looking for sort of a project that has like a nice limited amount of scope.
The challenge with it is like, so the email itself is simple enough. Like it's right. If it weren't for having to connect to the server and dealing with all of that, the code itself isn't all that complicated. But even working with John's article and following through the app password thing, I think I know what I'm doing. And so I ignored two of the steps and things started failing. And it had nothing to do with the actual Python script. It was I couldn't get the credentials I needed for Google to get going. Yeah. And so like you spin on that kind of stuff, it's very easy because these are protected. And in fact, in the video course, I start with, there's a dummy third-party server you can download. And so I start by teaching connecting to that, because if you don't have your credentials or anything else sorted, you can learn how all this works and you can play in your sandbox.
Yeah.
And then once you understand it, then I add the whole Lex Authenticate thing afterwards, because that can be messy. Yeah.
Yeah. This episode is sponsored by Ori by Endor Labs. Security and development have always felt like two separate worlds. Security finds something wrong, drops a ticket, and moves on. Ori is trying to close that gap. It's a free set of tools that plugs into your editor via MCP, so you're catching vulnerabilities, blocking malicious packages, and fixing security issues as you code, not weeks later in a backlog. Worth checking out at endorlabs.com. That's endorlabs.com. So as was mentioned, I am going to talk a little bit about Polars and about the recent update. So I combined these two pieces together. The quick piece is by previous guest Thijs Nudorp. It's titled Announcing Polars 1.41. Each of the new features has an associated PR number and a link if you'd like to do a little more exploration, if you're interested. And generally, it's just Polars looking at ways to become more efficient and faster. And the first one was faster Parquet metadata decoding. Parquet is a popular format, especially in the data science world. It eclipses things like CSVs because it adds types to your columns. It's also more compressed in some ways, I think partly because of the ability to identify the types that are inside of it. So there's a feature called Scan Parquet, and that call starts by reading and decoding the Parquet metadata that's stored in the footer. And the footer contains the column statistics, row, group, metadata, and type information. And for really wide tables with multiple columns or many row groups, decoding this footer was a measurable part of the total scan time. So now that Parquet's metadata schema is stable, 1.41 replaces the generic decoder with a handwritten one specialized for it. You don't have to change anything in your code to get these benefits. The existing Scan Parquet calls get the speed up automatically. Nested common subplan elimination. It has to do with deduplication of data inside of your Polars queries. Polars query optimizer detects when there's the same subplan in multiple branches of a query and replaces repeated evaluations with a single cached result. The detection for this same structure previously only worked at one level of nesting. If there were multiple branches, the work would be repeated, and 1.41 fixes this by traversing into cache nodes during the elimination pass. So now deduplication applies at every nesting depth. LazyFrame.gather, you can select rows by integer index. This wasn't available for lazy frames before. You would have to materialize the frame first. It means now row selection by index can stay inside of the lazy API. So if you're interested in learning a little bit more about any of those, the article will be in the show notes. And like I said, you can dive into each of the PRs for more information. But what I thought was fun is the team from Posit came back from PyCon, and one of the people from their group Isabella Velasquez wrote a piece talking a little bit more about pollers. It's titled Libraries for Your Python Pollers Workflows. Posit makes a whole bunch of tools that can enhance working with pollers. Two, we've covered on the show a few times, so I'm not going to dive too deep into them. One is Great Tables for creating publication quality tables, and Plot9, which is great for doing the grammar of graphics and following in R's ggplot2 style of visualizations. And they're both very, very useful if you haven't checked them out. So you can find more information from previous episodes. I'll include links for them. Or also there's a whole course on Plot9 type visualizations from RealPython. But there are two others that I think people might find useful that you can follow along in this tutorial. Point Blank is for data validation and quality checks, and MAL, M-A-L-L, which is used for LLM-powered data analysis. The tutorial has you install all four libraries. Suggestion, as usual, you should do that in a virtual environment. Even though they don't show that, I would suggest you do that. And then it provides the code to walk you through some of the functionality of each of the libraries, which I think is great. You import the libraries and the different components for Plot9, since it has quite a few components you can add. You set up a data frame. It involves some sales data. Point Blank is, again, for data validation and the quality of your data. So you look through the columns of the data and then set up checks on the values. So looking for any null values would be a common thing, making sure the types are correct, making sure, in this case, sales numbers are within a specified range. You can say, are the sales within 0 to 10,000 or something like that? You can confirm that the customer rating responses are between 1 and 5. And then you can check to make sure values for the regions are set. In this case, there are regions for the north, south, east, and west. So maybe something's outside of that. It outputs a really nice looking table with results, partly because it has great tables under the hood. It provides pass, fail, but you can also set thresholds for like warning or error or critical. So you can use that validation results to filter your tables or extract problematic data or trigger downstream processes if you'd like. So the next section gets into Great Tables itself. Again, I've talked about it a lot on the show, but it's really nice. They show you working with headers, subheadings, formatting currency, formatting numbers, creating a nano plot with little graphs inside of your tables, editing the color, styling, font sizes, even footnotes to your tables and how to format all that stuff. So a good tour of that. And then Plot9 is a refresher, again, for our audience on the grammar of graphics. I'll include the link to our RealPython tutorial and video course on that if you'd like to learn a little more. It takes you through a tour of set up plots inside of it. And then finally, the piece wraps up with MAL, which I hadn't heard of. It can provide AI-powered insights. She has set it up with Ollama, so a local model, but it can work with OpenAI, Anthropic, or other providers through the chatlist package. So the tutorial takes you through using MAL to add natural language descriptions to the sales data and rating information as far as, does this meet our specifications as far as low or medium or high? Other kind of operations you can do, you can set up LLM classifying, categorizing data into predefined labels. You can do sentiment analysis with it, summarization, which you mentioned already, translate to other languages or other verification steps if you'd like. So it might be a handy tool for you if you are using LLMs in your data science workflow. MAL might help you out. Thanks, Isabella, for giving us this nice tour of tools from Posit. All right, you ready for your next one?
Sure, let's do this. My next article is by friend of the show, Adam Johnson, who's a frequent contributor and mainstay in the Django community. The article is titled Introducing Django Integrity Policy and is about a newish security header on the web. To include outside content in your web page, like JavaScript files, you use the script tag. You use the tag's source attribute to specify the URL of what you're loading. The tag also has an optional attribute called integrity. Stan's dad grows the best stuff. Yeah, that's probably a generational specific deep cut. But anyways, the purpose of the integrity tag is to contain a hash of the thing you're loading. If the hash doesn't match the actual thing downloaded, the browser blocks the load. This is to help secure against the upstream provider changing the contents of the URL without your knowledge. So essentially helping you to avoid a supply chain attack against the visitors to your site. So that's the integrity attribute. Well, the integrity policy header allows you to tell the browser how to behave encountering those integrity attributes. In fact, you can now force their requirement on the page. Setting the header to blocked destination script style, that's a mouthful, tells the browser that any script or style sheet on the page must have one of these integrity attributes, and if it doesn't, to block loading. You can even set up a URL to be called if this policy gets violated, sending you a report that it happened. This requires a couple of extra headers to get going, but it means you'll be made aware if something has gone awry. A while back, I referred to this header as new-ish because Firefox added the capability last fall. It was a bit of a laggard. It has been in Chrome and Opera for 6 to 8 months before that. In fact, the Mozilla documentation that I looked at this morning, the header still shows as not being supported in those little checkbox things. What browser supports this? And Firefox doesn't check itself, even though it released it in 145. Anyway, Adam didn't just write an article on this. Being a Django guy and one deeply interested in the security side of things, he also wrote a Django library. It's called Django-Integrity-Policy, and it provides a bit of middleware that ensures the header gets injected into every page that you render in your Django project. Configuration is relatively simple. You need to add the middleware and a single setting to specify what you want to keep and what you want to block. Interestingly, the article also mentions another library that can be useful, which I hadn't heard of, Django-SRI, which gives you a template tag that generates your script and link HTML tags and includes the calculated integrity attribute hash. So that's nice because I used to hard code all that crap. So let it do it for you. That's fantastic. Using headers like this can help protect you and your site's visitors from one avenue of attack. So Adam's library is a good one to add to your Django toolkit.
I was thinking about this as I was looking at some older projects. Again, I'm re-entering the Django world. I had played with it much more 7 years ago. And we've talked about that idea of like shadow IT and things running, you know, under a desk and so forth. And so I didn't have outside web stuff. So I was ending up having to download entire JavaScript libraries and just like have them in a folder and similar, you know, to like CSS or other, you know, tools like Bootstrap, all these things that normally you just maybe say, well, go out to the web and grab, you know, a version of this stuff. I was having to keep on board, but this is making me feel a little more comfortable. The idea of like having it have a bit of a integrity check if I'm going to have to go look for things.
Sure. The flip side of it is there's a call out in his article that actually says you should never use a CDN for JavaScript libraries. Oh, wow. So
so maybe keep them local anyway.
He seems to be, he admits you can't always get away with it, but his preference is to actually feed it local so you're in control. Mm. So, yeah.
Yeah, I guess it depends on what you're building and how small it needs to be, maybe. I don't know.
Yeah, the advantage of the CDN is, you know, if all the sites have, you know, if five different sites all use the same package, your browser only gets it once because it's going to the same URL. That was more important when bandwidth was the limiting factor, and bandwidth isn't as much of a limiting factor anymore.
Individual images will probably eclipse any JavaScript you might be grabbing.
Whereas a supply chain attack is something we're becoming increasingly worried about, right? So, his preference seems to be download, check it, know what you have, and then, you know, keep it there because then you don't have to worry about it.
All right. Yeah, it makes sense. I guess, that's the balancing act between the two. But
always, yeah.
Yeah.
And you don't always have a choice, right? So depending on who you're developing for and whatever. So, yeah.
It's time to shine a spotlight on another RealPython video course. The AI ecosystem is highly fragmented. Each provider exposes its own API, authentication scheme, rate limits, and model lineup. Working with multiple providers often requires additional setup and integration effort. And what if you want to experiment with different models, compare outputs, or evaluate trade-offs for a specific task? Well, that's where this course comes in. The title is Accessing Multiple AI Models with the OpenRouter API. It's based on a written tutorial by Nuno Bispo, and the course is presented by video instructor Joseph Peart. And he takes you through getting started with OpenRouter, how to access thousands of models from leading providers like OpenAI, Anthropic, Mistral, Google, and Meta, then how to switch between models without changing your application code, how to use intelligent routing, modify routing behavior, and implement model fallbacks. and then how to weigh your options when you're selecting a model. RealPython video courses are broken into easily consumable sections, and where needed, include code samples for the techniques shown. Our newest courses, like this one, also have exercises for you to practice your knowledge as you work through the course. All lessons have a transcript, including closed captions. Check out the video course. You can find a link in the show notes, or you can find it using the search tool on realpython.com. My next piece is by previous guest, Bob Belderboss. In fact, I've talked about him recently, about him being on a journey. As I noted, he's been learning Rust. It sort of reinforced ideas about how to write Python for him. On the flip side, he's also been doing lots of experiments with AI and coding with agents. And so this piece is more in that vein. The piece is titled, How to Keep Your Developer Instincts When AI Writes the Code. And I think it's kind of a nice cautionary sort of piece to think about here. You hear, God, the hype cycle is just at its highest peak, I think, right now. And the backlash is about similarly. So if you stick your head up, it's like, oh my gosh, what's going on out here? So I feel there's a lot of people saying it's ruining my skills and making me less of a developer. And so he's kind of in that vein thinking about, well, how do you maintain that? And many AI tools have this promise. This promise was less friction. The cost, it turns out, is instinct, a high price to pay. The answer, add deliberate practice to your routine and keep the struggle. So again, the AI tools are promising ship with zero friction, and he focuses on why that's a lie. Friction is inherent to shipping. In especially increasingly complex software, there's going to be friction there. So it also is what he feels keeps engineers sharp. Starting, engineers need friction. To get to a certain level, developing intuition, experience, and judgments to make an effective and responsible use of all these new tools. You may feel, especially a lot of beginners and intermediate people, that it is all friction, learning how to code and work through these different things. And that's good. I mean, I feel that, you know, as I'm learning a new instrument, it's like, okay, yeah, this doesn't sound so good. And oh, wait, maybe I should learn how to use finger picks. Oh God, they suck, you know, or whatever it is. And you have this moment where you're like, okay, you finally have those breakthroughs. He has three different kinds of frictions that he sort of wants to define in this. Friction that's worth deleting, which would be things that the AI could do for you and you're not really going to miss much. This is like boilerplate, configuration syntax, format conversions, dependency lookups. Agents are really good at this stuff, grinding through well-known patterns. And generally, this isn't going to really sharpen anything for you in the process. And unfortunately, that's a small portion of what goes into real-world applications. Then he talks about the friction worth keeping. Sitting with a design decision until you can defend it in one sentence is one of the things he talks about. Really going into like what is happening here. He actually has it read the diffs and then push back on the approach that was there, asking why this was selected. I have this conversation with the AI tool, which I think is always kind of interesting. Like, why was this? Is this the best approach to doing this? What are other types of approaches? Different types of queries you could kind of throw in here. And this is where he feels like instinct gets built. And then there's friction that he feels like there's worth seeking out, going one level below your daily stack of abstraction, writing by hand the thing that you would normally prompt, reading the source library. If you're going to use a new library, read what that library is, especially if you're going to depend on it and find out what its features are, and doing that with the friction of like going through it from end to end. Sort of deliberate practice. Coding with agents makes it easier to skip the hard parts. You can build faster, but without processing the problems that you intended to solve. He shares a deliberate practice routine for AI era developers. Form the expectation before prompting. Decide what the answer should look like. Again, I throw that out there, spec-driven development, this idea of like writing down what you want. If you get a result that does not match, you don't have to by default accept it. Having this idea of going back and prompting again, asking why this was done this way. Test-driven development has a similar discipline applied kind of even earlier, write the test first and then let it define what correct means before any of the code is written. He talks about reading the diffs again, read the diff like a junior wrote it. This seems right, is not really a review. Have the model argue against itself. What is the strongest case against this approach as an example? And then one time a week, be solo at the keyboard, a 2-hour block, no agents, and just try coding, working on the stuff and keeping, if you will, things sharp. He wraps up with some thoughts about junior developers and onboarding. They may not have ever experienced this form of friction and introducing it to them. I have a conversation coming up with somebody who's been a testing engineer and worked at lots of different organizations. And so that experience was something that he could bring into this environment. And then as he started using AI tools, he was like, wait, there's a bunch of missing steps here. And so he's developing these loops that are less about agentic just crunching away on things, but like, how can we enhance specifications? How can we enhance tests? How can we judge the quality of things? So I think this is in conversation with that. And so that'll be coming out in a couple of weeks here. And he has some final thoughts about keeping the struggle. Autopilot feels productive, but what is the toll? What atrophies in that process? It's a good piece. It's kind of, again, a thought piece. I don't know if you have anything you want to mention here, like this idea of, I have less experience of working with like junior developers and onboarding them. And I could imagine right now it being kind of precarious, but also like, do you in your own practice, I have let my skills atrophy, I will say, as a coder, because I just was not having the time. I was working full-time, running multiple things in my life and at my work. And it's nice. I feel really good getting back into coding and working on stuff and even loading up my old projects. And people talk about that, reading their old code and understanding how it works and so forth and kind of sharpening from there. But I don't know if you have a similar experience.
I think any skill in life, if you stop practicing it for a while, it's going to atrophy. I think it comes back faster than learning it the first time.
Yes.
It's refamiliarizing yourself with it. But, you drop something on the floor and don't touch it for a long time, it's going to be a problem. I've got a buddy of mine who's fairly deep into this space, and he's now decided, I think it's every 3 or 4 days, he does a sabbatical day.
Okay.
So he just does not use the LLM tech for one of the days every 3 or 4 days. And he said something interesting to me when we were talking about it the other day. He's no longer convinced that, like, he's like, I enjoy doing it. I like working with it. I like talking to it. I'm not sure it's making me more productive, because my days where I'm using it and my days where I'm not using it seem to be about the same.
Yeah.
Now, your mileage is going to vary. He's not doing the kind of stuff where there's a lot of boilerplate. So like, some of its strengths are things he might not be taking advantage of, right? So I am at risk of our comment section turning into a flame war.
Yeah, yeah.
I think, I'm sure Yo-Yo Ma still does his scales, right? Like, there's
sure.
practice, and you can be at the top of your game and you still need to, keep honing the edge. Now I'm gone from music to chefery. I think mixing my metaphors here, but
there's a lot of that in this piece. And I was adding my own. Yeah. I had another one recently that I just thought about too, is this idea that we've introduced this like massive tool that's extremely powerful, but everything that we attach to it is not honed to the point where it works right. It's like this friend of mine, Rob, he was one of those guys that would just have like work on cars in his garage. And, I'm going to take an engine out of this Lexus. I'm going to put it into a Toyota. I'm like, okay. And so you would have things like a massive air compressor, and then all these like tools or things that he would attach to it and so forth. And I feel like we've built like the massive machine first, but we have not refined how the tools attach to this stuff. And it's just kind of like needs to be honed, and then how you use those things.
Those things take time. And I think, this is a shift in how we're doing things. And those always take a long time to sort of come out, right? Like,
yeah,
some of what's going on is not going to be considered best practice 10 years from now, and people will be scratching their heads and going, why?
Yeah.
And then there's going to be other stuff that they're going to look at me, the dinosaur, and go, how did you ever survive without, like, yeah, right? Like, so
right,
I can't imagine starting coding without books on my shelf, and yet now, yes, that's not, yeah, how, yeah, you do it, right? So these things change.
Yeah. All right. Well, that takes us into projects. What do you got for your project this week?
My project this week is called Lifeguard, and it's from this little company you may have heard about called Facebook. Well, they're called Meta now, but they didn't rename their GitHub account. So the URL actually says Facebook owns it, even though the page uses the new branding. Anyhow, Lifeguard is a static analysis tool to help with lazy imports. You've probably heard of us talk about these before. They're coming in the Python 3.15 release. And right now, when your code hits the import keyword, the module gets loaded, even if you aren't using anything inside of it. The lazy import mechanism will allow the load to be delayed until the point where you use the content. This can be handy for programs like command line tools that have subcommands, where not everything gets used on every invocation, and making lazy loading means there'll be less that needs to be loaded at startup time, and therefore the program should load faster. Of course, switching something to be lazily loaded has consequences, and not all modules are going to be happy with working that way. There are some coding patterns that won't work with lazy loading. For example, your module might have side effects that trigger on loading, like registering a handler. That may not behave well if the loading is deferred. This can get particularly tricky with code that uses sys.modules, looking at what modules are or are not loaded yet, or some kinds of metaclasses. This can be a little messy. So enter Lifeguard. When you call Lifeguard on your code, it loads it all into an abstract syntax tree, then walks the source. It has a list of patterns that might cause problems if lazily loaded. And if your module or any of the modules it calls matches one of these patterns, it marks it as not being lazy load compatible. The documentation says that the tool errs on the side of aggression. It aims to do false positives rather than false negatives. They'd rather it catches something that might be problematic so that you can look at it rather than miss something to have it fail over. The project's still in beta. In fact, it can't even read 3.15 code yet, which is interesting because it's a tool for 3.15. But the intent is for that to be working and other features at the release of 3.15 in the fall. So they're working on this as they go along. If you're planning on taking advantage of lazy imports in your project, Lifeguard's worth checking out.
Yeah, I imagine with the second beta and their chance to kind of keep testing it against the new version should help refine it here.
I just found it funny. I'm going through the documentation or reading it. There's like this note and it's buried. Like it's three quarters of the way down. It's like, this doesn't work on the lazy import keyword yet. And I'm like, isn't that what we're doing?
Interesting. Yeah. Kind of wild. So my next one is kind of an interesting story. We've discussed the request library multiple times on the show. In fact, it was the very first video course I ever did for Real Python. Because I was very intrigued by it and how to use it to access APIs and other things like that. But as a library, it has been languishing. There's some functionality that was missing, and there's been some other tools that have come along. HTTPX is one of the ones, and I have mentioned it maybe before in the show. It's a fully featured HTTP client for Python 3, and it provided sync and async APIs, which was unique there, and also support for HTTP 1.1 and HTTP 2. It built on the established usability of requests, which was one of the things everybody liked about requests, is that it was fairly human-friendly as far as reading it. That was like one of the shout-outs there. But that library has been languishing also, and incoming from the team at Pydantic, they decided, well, let's pick up where HTTPX is left off and build on top of it, and they've named their project HTTPX2. Their stewardship comes with the team there. Pydantic has some funding. They're the team that also, you know, is involved with Fast API, and so there's a lot of work behind the scenes that's happening, and so it's good to see it passing into these hands. It's the continuation of some wonderful work that was started by @LovelyDinosaur, that's their GitHub title. They were the people behind HTTPX. It basically is a broadly request compatible API. It integrates a command line client, HTTP 1.1 and HTTP 2 support, again, standard synchronous interface, but with async support if you need it, and then ability to make requests directly to WSGI, WSGI applications, or ASGI applications. And so another offshoot called HTTP XYZ was out there, and they were working on their successor, if you will, forking HTTPX. They had not seen a whole lot of activity recently, and then a few weeks later, Pydantic started their own fork here with HTTPX2. So they decided to embrace this and support HTTPX2. They're upstreaming any of the fixes they had for HTTPX2. They are looking for this to be this nice blessed fork, and Pydantic can make this more successful than they ever could. So I'll include some links here. I'm excited to see this. If you're interested in doing things and working with APIs, I think this is a nice change here, this new generation of HTTP clients for Python. So check it out. All right, Chris. Well, congratulations on helping me get to episode 300 here.
Well, I can only take a third of the credit, so it's all you, my friend.
Thanks. All right, well, I'll talk to you soon.
Take care.
Thanks to Ori by Endor Labs for sponsoring this week's show. It's free to try and quick to get started. Check it out for yourself at endorlabs.com. I want to say thanks to Christopher Trudeau for coming on the show again this week. And I want to thank you for listening. If you like the episode, a great way to help us grow our audience is to share it with other Python users who you think might enjoy it. You can also leave a rating or a review on your podcast platform of choice. If you or your company are interested in sponsoring the podcast, you can find all the information at realpython.com/advertise. You can find show notes with links to the topics we spoke about inside your podcast player or at realpython.com/podcast. And while you're there, you can leave us a question or a topic idea. I've been your host, Christopher Bailey, and I look forward to talking to you soon.